why is the cosmological constant small? Or if it's not small, why is its effect on our geometry, the geometry of the universe, so small? Now, people, I mean, there's a lot of ideas floating around to try to explain this. We've got quintessence, which is the universal band-aid, right, that physicists do. It's just, there's something we can't explain, well, let's plug in a scalar field and see what happens. There's also k-essence, which is basically screwing around with the kinetic current in the action. There's a whole bunch of ideas for modifying gravity, either, you know, higher order curvature terms, or this conformal gravity, or, I mean, people here are probably much more, you know a lot more about this than I do. There's also, lately, there's been a lot of talk about the anthropic principle, and I have more question marks here than I do at the other points, and that's the only editorial comment I'll make on that. And you have extra dimensions in brain worlds, which have been very fashionable lately, and we're going to be talking about brain worlds. Okay, so what's so special about codimension 2 brain worlds? Why not codimension 1? Why not codimension n different from 2? The main thing is that, okay, in if you look at 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity, okay, just gravity in 3D, and you have a point source, the space is not going to curve. All that's going to happen is that it's going to induce a conical singularity. So anywhere here, I mean, somebody living here is not going to see any curvature from this source. The only way you're going to see curvature is when you go in a circle that encompasses the source, and you're going to find out that the radius of this circle is not equal to 2 pi times, the circumference of the circle is not equal to 2 pi times the radius, you know, the distance away from the center of the circle. So all that matter sources do in two dimensions is induce deficit angles, which are proportional to the tension on the source. Now notice that from a higher dimensional perspective, so these two directions are the extra dimensions. And this could be a tree brain. So this tree brain could have a huge tension, right? A huge vacuum energy living on this brain. And all it's going to do is it's going to induce a conical singularity in the extra dimensions, instead of leading to expansion on the brain. So normally we think there's vacuum energy, our space will expand. But here, what happens is all it does is induce a conical singularity in the ball. So they don't curve as strong in space. So naturally we look at that and say, well, this is, it's great for the cosmological constant problem. So suppose that we find a static switch, right? So the metric looks like this. This is the external space, the large dimensions. There can be or not be a vacuum. And these are the extra dimensions, and the coordinates I'm using here are polar coordinates. Now near the brain, this thing is going to go like r squared times a constant, and this constant is related to the deficit angle. Now to find a solution with a tension t, and then you change the tension, you can find another static solution simply by rescaling this d here. Simply by, basically, if you change the tension on the brain, you're going to change the deficit angle, and nothing else. Pictorially, it looks like this. Okay, so you start out with, so here we have a compact internal space with 2-3 brains at the poles. If you change the tensions, then the deficit angles are going to change, but you might think that you're not going to induce any expansion on the brains. So we know that static solutions exist for any value of the tension, right? But note the asterisk here. Okay, when you look more carefully at the model, then things are going to start going bad. So actually, in Einstein-Hilbert gravity, so if you have a model for Einstein-Hilbert gravity in 6 dimensions, and you have a compact space like I just showed you with 2-3 brains, the Hubble rate is not necessarily 0. But it's also not related to the tension on the brain. It's going to be related to bulk parameters, so the bulk cosmological constant. And here, beta squared is related to the field strain from the bulk 2-fold. So the action looks like this. And you need this thing in order to get a compact internal space. So the interplay between all these terms is going to compactify the internal space. And the brain is going to be a 2D delta function. And it's going to be canceled by a singular, you know, a delta function term coming from the 6-dimensional Ricci scalar. And that's all it's going to do. And the expansion on the brain is going to be governed by bulk parameters, not by the energy density that's living on the brain. So you still have to do a fine-tuning between these parameters to get zero expansion. But on the other hand, you found a way to disconnect the expansion rate on the brain from the fact of energy density on the brain. So it's a good thing, but it's also not completely satisfying because you still have a fine-tuning. Now, 6D supergravity, on the other hand, is even better than that. What it does for you, well, here's the relevant part of the action, first of all. So you have a dilaton, which you didn't have in the Einstein Hilbert action, and you have this basically a nonlinear sigma model. And you'll notice that if you set these fields to constants, and you set the dilaton to a constant value, then this action looks exactly like the one I just showed you before. Okay? And the potential for these fields here is going to play the role basically of a 16 cosmological function. So it looks like the same action I had before for Einstein-Hilbert gradient, except that now you have an equation of motion for the dilaton. And when the dilaton is stable, this equation actually forces you to have the parameters to be what they need to be to get a static solution on the brain. Now this here comes from the equations of motion, and that was pointed out by, well, Cliff Lavery. So this looks very promising, because now the equations of motion are telling you that whatever you have on the brain, the bulk parameters are going to lead to a static solution. So now let's dig a bit deeper into these models. Okay? For Einstein-Hilbert gravity, I told you that it looks like the expansion rate on the brain is governed only by bulk parameters, not by the tension on the brain. But actually, if you dig a bit deeper, you find that there is a fine-tuning of the brain tensions. So let's start with, okay, bulk cosmological constant of the field strain, 2 to get a static solution. Okay. So now you have this internal space is static, the brain is static. Now let's change one of the tensions. What happens if you do that? Now, I told you the brain produces deficit angles in the ball, right? So this means that if you change one of the tensions, then the deficit angle around that brain changes. If the deficit angle changes, the volume of the internal space is going to change. However, now we have a U1H field in the ball, and the solutions here we have are a monopole configuration. This means that the flux of this H field has to be conserved. Since we're changing the volume of the internal space, the field strain has to change, for the flux to remain constant. But in order to get a static solution, you need to tune the bulk cosmological constant with the field strain. So if you change your field strain, what happens is, as soon as you change tensions on one of the brains, then the tuning of the field strain and the bulk cosmological constant is spoiled. So the expansion rate on the brain will pick up a dependence on the tensions through this phenomenon. It's not direct, it's not as intuitive as expected, right? You don't find that the Hilbert rate is just proportional to the tension on the brain, but it is dependent on the tensions on the brain because of this thing. So we haven't really disconnected the Hilbert rate from the brain tension. Now in six-dimensional supergravity, Garriga and Parati claimed that the same type of reasoning can show that self-tuning cells in supergravity too. However, I just told you that supergravity and this tuning is enforced by the equations of motion. So how can it be how can you break this tuning? So what they did is they showed that you could write down an effective four-dimensional that reproduces the same equations of motion as the 6D theory. And it has a potential that looks like this, where these fields sigma 1 and sigma 2 are linear combinations of the dilaton and the radion. Now notice that we have one part here depending only on sigma 1, and one part depending only on sigma 2. When the dilaton and the radion are static, this part here vanishes like this. Which means that, and also the first derivative with respect to sigma 1 also vanishes. So this potential and its derivatives with respect to the fields are zero. So for a static dilaton and radion, I mean, this is a stable point. The static solution is fine. Now, if you change attention on one of the brains, what you're going to do effectively is change these constants, k, big K and little k. If you change them, then this thing is not zero anymore. If this thing is not zero anymore, you can see that the field sigma 2 is going to rock, is going to want to roll away from the tipping. Okay? So what happens is that the model basically is unstable to perturbations in the brain tensions. And this thing, this tuning, which was enforced previously by the equations of motion, it's enforced by the equations of motion if the dilaton and the radion are stable. Here, they become unstable, they roll away. So this tuning is now destroyed by changing the brain tensions. Okay. So why am I still here, right? What am I talking to you about this for if people have shown that it's not right?
You said that it's already effective for tuning?
Yes, that's
what I was talking about. The chances that it was itself tuning would work and effective for
tuning. Right, it can. Well, which was their point. They said, you know, one version of the theorem applies to this because that's an effective for tuning theory, and, you know, let's wrap this up and forget about it. But, see, why am I still talking about it?
Maybe it's not so bad that they have an unstable field because maybe some kind of iridescence or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, you could think that it's not going to roll away so fast.
Right.
Yeah. But their point was that you don't get a self-tuning explosion, right? Because yes. That's what people are looking for, is self-tuning. So yeah, if a field rolls away, it could still be that the model is good, but you don't get a self-tuning explosion.
Excuse me.
Yes.
So the kinetic terms of sigma 1 and sigma 2, they don't play any role, I mean, when it starts. And so that also contributes to the same, in the same direction.
Yes. So what you have is, you just have a potential. The kinetic terms are standard. Right? They have the right signs. So you will just fold. Okay, but there's one point, though, that the analysis of the Riemann variety did not take. So, given Gubin and Vogt found all the solutions to these types of 6D supergravity compactified models where you have axial symmetry in the bulk, you have static internal space, static dilaton, have a bulk to form compactified internal space, and a maximally symmetric surface. They classified and found all solutions to those. And they show that the only solutions are one where the external space is static. Now, note, though, that they did assume that the internal space and the dilaton were static, which in Garriga and Poran's case, they say that these things roll away from the thing. However, the argument of Garriga and Poran, it only applies to one class of solutions to these models. It ignores completely an entire other class of solutions where the brains don't give you conical singularity. So the brains are more have a different structure. So just for your enjoyment, here are the solutions. Here's what they look like. And your even important argument applies when this parameter here, lambda 2, is equal to 0. Okay. But there's a whole class of solutions, so lambda 3 appears here. And when lambda 3 is not 0, then you have a whole other class of static solutions.
Let's say it's even worse than that. Their argument doesn't even apply when lambda 3 is 0 necessarily.
It doesn't apply when they're forking. Their active forking would change their picture though.
No, it does, because the thing is that essentially what they did is they truncated the six-dimensional environment in four dimensions. And then they analyzed, the question they wanted to ask was, what happens if you change dimensions? And the question they actually did answer was, what happens in this four-dimensional theory? And their connection was that, the statement was that if you truncated the six-dimensional theory, that would capture the physics that you get if you change dimensions. And these guys have the graphs of counterexamples where the first thing that happens when you change dimensions is that the output geometry works all that loose fine modes turn on.
Right.
And they set them all to zero. That's why the analysis doesn't work.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So what's going to happen is that so you have these two brains. If the brains have equal tensions, then there's no work. Now, if you change the tension of one brain, keep one brain stable, change the tension on the other brain, you can either get warping, right, or you can get a runaway solution under even points. And their argument is that there's only a line if you plot the two tensions, there's only a There's only a line in the space of tensions where you can have static solutions. Right. So if, as soon as you're off this line, whether or not they're four, it can still be still,
That's solidified.
So I think
let's make it clear so that argument that you just made is true, and that's saying in a six dimensional equation is what can you say with the solution.
Right.
And then it depends on what the method is, but that was our argument. That their argument is what they're saying inclusive because it's the whole problem is there's no separation of scales between the inclusive line scale and the modes you're trying to follow. That you change dimensions.
Right.
And the assumption that goes into their four dimensional analysis is that you can separate the closed plan scales from the four dimensional fields that you
sure.
have.
Yeah.
And there's no reason, there's no
there's no role in their effective
output.
So they don't think,
But beyond that, there's no demand approximation where that would be a good approximation.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, I agree. Okay. But anyways, what we want to see is, and there's a whole class of static solutions with London 3 non-zero, where the singularities of the brain are not. So basically, the internal space now in polar coordinates looks like this near the brain. So instead of having a constant times r squared, which would just look like a cone, the r has a different power from r squared. So it looks maybe sort of like a trumpet or something, but it's not like r squared, so it's not just a conical singularity. And this was pointed out by the buffer. So what we want to know now is if you start with a static solution with conical singularities, okay, and you perturb one of the tensions, what happens? Okay, one possibility is this. Right? So you can start with a nice static solution, change one of the tensions, and you'll have the whole thing go well. The other possibility is you start with conical singularities, you perturb one of the tensions, and you get another static solution, but with non-conical singularities. And we want to know which one of these happens. Right? So to do this, we have to follow the interesting thing is in this blue arrow here, right? How do you get from here to there? That's what we have to check. So that's what we set out to do. So the questions we wanted to answer, in order to do that, if you really want to follow the dynamics as the brain tension changes, then you have to allow for brains with an equation of state that allows for time-dependent matter on the brain. And I haven't emphasized this, but all the work that people have done so far concern only pure tension brains. And if you want to have general types of matter on the brain, then it's a lot more complicated, as I'll explain. Another question we'd like to answer is, do we recover standard cosmology? So in order to do that, well, we need to have several. We need to be able to put anything we want. And finally, well, we want to be able to check if there is a substitute. Okay, so just to remind you, if we were asking these same questions concerning codimension 1 brains, it would be rather simple. Well, it would be simpler, let's say. Because then the delta function terms, right, from the brain have to be matched with the delta function terms from the gravitational part of the action. And these delta function terms in the gravitational part are going to come from discontinuities in the warp vector. So these G00 and GII, where these are the three large spatial directions. So the metric components, if their first derivatives are discontinuous at the brain, right, then the second derivative has a delta function term, and then you can match that to the matter living on the brain. And all you need is for the warp factor to be different along the time and space directions in order to accommodate a brain with a general equation. So for codimension 1 brains, it's been well studied and people know how to do it. For codimension 2 brains, however, the two-dimensional delta function looks like this. And what happens is that if you want to match delta functions in the stress energy tensor, the delta functions in the Einstein tensor, you're going to need to do it with terms that look like grad squared ln of metric components. Now, for pure tension brains, the metric components that are going to be relevant here are the extra dimensional metric components. It's the GRR, which, it's the G theta theta term, is the one that scales like R near the brain. Right? So you're going to have something like grad squared ln of r. That's going to give you a 2D delta. But if you want to have matter with an arbitrary equation of state, then you're going to need grad squared ln of you know, the time and space component. So these things would have to scale like arcs of power in the brain. But remember, we want to be living on the brain, and we don't want the metric to be blowing up or vanishing where we're living. So we're going to have to regularize the brain somehow. And this is where thick gradients come in. So what we're going to do is simply going to regularize the brain using a step function instead of a delta function. And in the end, we're going to, well, we could, if we want, allow the radius of this wing to go to zero. So Victoria leave this switch again. So instead of having, you know, singular behavior here, we chop it off and we demand that everything be nice and smooth at the, you know, at the pole here, and we make the brain thick. So this gets rid of the singular behavior. It does reduce the expected delta function solution in this zero fit just a bit, if you put pure tension on this thick brain diagram. So you can check that. It also allows us, well, not, okay. I said it allows for you to detune the deficit angle and brain tension. That's not really true. What it does is allow us to have a dynamic deficit angle. Whereas previously, if you had a pure tension brain, the deficit angle always has to be just equal to whatever's on the brain. And you can't really follow dynamics because that's not a, questions of motion don't accommodate the time dependent deficit angle. Here, we will be able to, so that's also interesting. Now, in order to be able to, you know, treat everything analytically and nicely, we're going to do a derivative analysis. So this, these S functions here are the brain stress efficient tensor. So it's a step function of, with time dependent things. Okay. And it could have a background tension plus a this will treat this row of T here on the brain as a perturbation to the background tension. And this will put the time dependent particle of this particular cell. And we're going to have two brains, right? So there's a brain at every at both poles of the space. And the thickness of each brain is not necessarily going to be equal. And we're going to treat the time dependence as a perturbation also. So we're going to expand this step function. So you have here you have a constant step function plus a one-dimensional delta function times the function. So effectively, your brain stress energy is going to look like the background part, which is just the constant. And then you have a step function times the perturbation. And you also have a 1D delta function that's sort of wrapping this thick brain part.
You didn't have that last term, would it work?
No, it doesn't. That's something we were hung up on for a long time. What happens is if you don't have this degree of freedom, then the equation of motion, they imply a natural relation between different components in the brain stress energy. So it's important to allow time dependence and the thickness. Actually, what we're going to do, I'll explain this in a minute, in order to simplify the equations greatly. So the first thing we did last year, we applied this formalism to Einstein-Hilbert gravity, and we did have a background tension on the brain. And once we were through with the calculation, we realized that including this term, and it brought nothing of value to the final answer. And all it did was make, you know, solving the equations much harder. So what we're going to do now, we're going to set this thing to zero. So we're going to say that our background has no tension on the brains. Our background has no brains. Okay? Now you might say, well, it doesn't make sense because now the 1D delta function isn't there. But we're just going to assume, we're just going to put it in by hand. We're going to say there is such a term. And in fact, when you solve everything, you see that this function goes like 1 over the tension. So we do cancel. So in the end, I mean, it's consistent to just plug in a function around the brain to encode the time variation of the thickness, even if you do neglect the background function. So here's a nice picture. So we have a 1D delta function here. We have a step function core where everything is smooth. There's nothing blowing up here at the pole. And you can read these people's papers where they also analyze in more general sense the boundary conditions at a co-dimension 2 brain, at a thick co-dimension 2 brain. And they both come to the conclusion that you do need to have some sort of a one-dimensional delta function there. It's a consistent.
So the thing you're curving around is about the tension to zero, and then
right.
is it the supersonic solution? Are you curving around
more generalized? It's a supersonic solution. So first of that,
that's the second one.
Okay, so now we get to the fun part of the talk for added weights. So we use the most general metric we can that has axial, that has cylindrical symmetry in the external space. And this is how we expand all our functions. So we have a background plus perturbation for all these things. And notice we have, so corporeally, the 3D part of the metric, we have a scale factor. And we also have a scale factor for the internal space, here V0 and C0 and T. And we're also going to expand the dilaton by plugging in a scale factor for the dilaton also. Now, all perturbations are going to be assumed to be of order rho, where rho is the perturbation to the frame tension. Except E1, the off diagonal term, it turns out just for the equations to be consistent, this term has to be rho 3 halves. Time derivatives of these functions are going to pick up an additional order rho in the 1 half, and that physically you can see that happening from just usual conservation of energy in cosmology. You have rho dot going like the Hubble rate times rho plus t. The Hubble rate is order square root of rho, so rho dot goes like rho plus 3 halves. So all time derivatives will assume pick up the order rho plus 1 half, additional rho. And the time derivatives of these scale factors, okay, so a dot over a squared and a double dot over a, this is more of order rho. And similarly for building B, C, and 5. So for simplicity, as I told you, we choose a brainless background instead of one where you already have brains. And our background is static and fun-form. Now, choosing the brainless solution, as I told you, makes the equation simpler, and it does not take away from the generality of it. The unwarped solution, they require the tension on both frames to be equal. Now that is not general, but we will allow our perturbations on the frames to not be equal. So perturbatively, I mean, we can have different values of the tensions on the frames. So perturbatively, we do have a general result. And as we've already seen, in 6D supergravity, choosing a static solution is the normal thing to do because it's singled out by the equation. So the solutions for the background functions are given here. It's not very enlightening to leave these up very long. The only thing I want you to notice is that the relation we have here between B, C, and phi, these sort of scale factors for these terms, at the background level we get relations so that only one of them survives. Okay, so if we started out with these three scale factors, we have two relations between them, so there's only one that's going to survive. I'm just going to write a C naught for principle.
So that you have kind of surface tension solution and you get a flat there. And those kind of tensions just rolling along the flat there.
Right, exactly. So this term, the only one that survives is the flat bridge. Okay. Now, to make equations of motion look not as bad as they would otherwise, I mean, and to make sure we don't get involved with, degrees of freedom which are just pure gauge, well, we choose to write everything in terms of these gauge invariant quantities. So these are the equations of motion. Just flash them by real quick. Give you a sense of what we have to solve. They're actually not bad because the primes are derivatives, right? Derivatives with respect to the radial extra dimension. And the dots are time derivatives. And they're all first order differential equations. They decouple nicely, except for the dilaton has a second order. Now, you might have noticed or not, I have to show this. Okay. Notice here, the function I'm going to call P6 is related to the difference between the angular and radial parts of the brain stress energy tensor. And this function P6 is going to be critical for the rest of the analysis, so just keep in mind. P6 is going to be related to the difference between the angular and radial process. Now, in the equations of motion, there's no dynamics for this P6. Okay? So we're free to choose it to be whatever we want to make the equation easier to solve. Now, ideally, we'd have a concrete model for the train. But here, we're just at a toy model, right? We have a step function train. So this is the choice we made, and the reason we made that choice, again, was just it made the equations simpler to solve. So we have radial dependence and the time dependence separated. And this is the function that's going to be important later. We'll furthermore assume that the perturbations to the brain stress energy tensor are functions of time only. And that's, it really doesn't matter because in the end we're going to integrate out the radial dependence of all these brain sources. So it doesn't matter really if we had given them radial dependence or not. So with these assumptions, the perturbed equation of motions are rather straightforward. Now, one thing we have to keep in mind is that so far everything has been written down in terms of six-dimensional quantities, and we want to know what a four-dimensional observer living on the brain is going to see. So we have to integrate out these six-dimensional quantities to get the effective four-dimensional energy density and pressure. Now, notice here this term, right? So this is just integrating out the rho of t that we put on the brain, and this term comes from the brain tip. So this here is the function that we plugged in. So this is related to one p delta function that we put right at the brain. And if this thing wasn't there, as I said before, the answer to this question, if this thing wasn't there, then the equations of motion would have imposed unnatural conditions on the stress energy level. So these things have to be those. So these are the four dimensional effective quantities that are going to be relevant to this. Also, we have to define the 4D Newton constant, and we do this by integrating over the 6D time mass. So you have a time-dependent Newton constant. Now we have to make sure that our solutions include the non-conical singularities, right? Because that's what we want to know. We want to know if we perturb the brains, does the model blow up, or do we move to these static non-conical solutions? So we have to make sure that our solutions do include this. So Higgins, Lewin, and Pope show that for a metric of this type, for a static, purely static solution, lambda 3 is basically a first integral of the equation of motion. Now, in our perturbative analysis, the dilaton is just a constant, and there's no warping in the background. So in the background, this lambda 3 is just static. And that makes sense because our background had no break, so you don't expect that non-conical singularities. But at the level of the perturbations, we can write it in this manner. So now we have to check if this thing is non-zero in our results. We solve the equations of motion, and we plug our results into this expression. Assuming that we have a static solution so that the scale factors are just constants, rho is equal to minus t, then we find that we do have a non-zero lambda 3 as long as the p6 terms are non-zero. And these p6 terms, well, they shouldn't be functions of time here because I've seen static solutions, but these p6 terms, you'll remember, are related to the exponential components of the brain stress energy. So our solutions do include non-conical singularities. And the dependence on the extra-dimensional part of the brain stress energy is consistent with the arguments that were given in the paper by the collaborators and also by Navarro and Santiago recently. Now we finally come to the Friedman equations. And so in brain world models, these come through imposing appropriate boundary conditions. In our case, this means that all functions are continuous across the junction between the brain and the ball. Their derivatives don't need to be because, as I was saying before, everything is first order. All we have are first derivatives. So the functions have to be continuous, except, of course, where you have to match with the 1D delta function. And finally, here are the Friedman equations. Once you've done all that, juggled everything together, these are the three main equations. So the Hubble rate square is proportional, as you'd expect, to 8 pi g over 3 rho. There's also a contribution coming, so rho star is from, so this would be the matter density on the brain we're living on. This would be the one on the other brain. But you notice that you have, you know, terms here coming from the non-stabilized direction. So this is the scale factor of, it's a linear combination of the dilaton and the radial.
If I can honestly normalize that node, would that just be the kinetic energy of that node? Would that be like 8 times G of the 3 times kinetic energy of the node?
I suspect it would, because, yeah, because, well, here I'm working the, basically I'm working in what's the equivalent of the barren transit. So if I change probably if there would, because you can show that these equations of motion are equivalent to Grand State here in the limit where the singularities are constant.
And what's Q?
Okay, yeah. Q here is just a constant that's related to the perturbation to the flux of the U1 to H2. So this Q at, you could set it to zero, right? If you say that the background flux is all you have, then this Q1 is zero. You say when I do perturbations, I'm going to allow myself to perturb the flux, then this thing would tell you how big the perturbation of the flux is.
So you can perturb it enough to violate the quantization?
Well, yeah, that's it. But you could say that the value of the flux which satisfies the quantization condition is the background plus Q1. Or you could say that if it's the background, then Q1 would have to be zero. But the important point is, if through a phase transition, right, if the value of rho changes, Q1 can never change. Once you set the value of the flux, whether or not you say that Q1 is zero or not, it's going to stay the same for the rest of the time. Right? It can't change. That's important. Okay. And the other equation of motion, so these are conservation of energy, and note that the presence of these P6 terms is going to violate, it's going to appear to a 4D observer as if you violated conservation of energy. So you can't really write down an effective four-dimensional theory when these P6 terms are there. And this is the equation of motion for this extra, for the extra. Now, the things that I have to notice, first of all, the Hubble rate depends, as in all brain constructions where you have more than one brain, it depends on the energy density on all brains. So if you want to have fun, you know, supposing, trying to say that the dark energy lives on another brain, dark matter lives on another brain, you can do that. For so fun. The constant Q1, as I already told, answer to this question is related to the flux. So it's just a constant, you can't change through the phase transition. An interesting thing to notice is that when these P6 functions are zero, right, then we have only conical singularities. And the results can be shown to be exactly equivalent to Grand Sticky theory with a flat potential and an omega factor of 1. And what's interesting is that this type of theory is ruled out by the fifth force experiments, time dependence of
Newton's
constant.
Well, that depends a lot on detail, so you depending exactly what the potential is. And
if the potential is flat, I mean, no, it doesn't depend on.
Well, it depends on things like, for literally the theory you wrote down, is classically there are no quantum corrections to it, then it could be.
Okay, sure.
But I know that in cases where you don't have these extra six terms, that depending on whether you have a logarithmic direction potential or not, and
it's
how much better you pass the balance. But if you get to the point where those are balanced, the dangerous thing, then actually you're happy because it means the whole math thing is even the delta. So one question would be, how big is the potential for this runaway mode? Is it something which is sweet, or is it,
Well, I mean, if you look at the equation of motion for this mode right here, so it's sourced by the basically the trace of the 4D particles. And it's also sourced by these P6. So if these P6 functions aren't there, then I would expect that it is ruled out. It just couples the trace of this. So it's just normal Grand Sticky theory. The action is going to look just like this. Just a Grand Sticky action with omega equal to 1/2. And the potential is just a constant in the Grand Sticky. In the Einstein frame, the potential is an exponential potential like the Riemann collateral.
But the coefficients you're saying scale, it depends upon the coefficient scale with the scale on the ring. And you're saying it's going to be m squared. So I think the previous slide was actually m squared. Because if these rows and these are all going to like m to the fourth, and g was like 1 over m squared.
Yeah, right. It's going to go like m squared where m is the ring.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. However, I mean, if you do have these p6 terms later, then you can have fun trying to say that this thing vanishes. You can use p6 terms to make the right hand side vanish and say that it would stabilize. Okay, so, but what about self-tuning? Because that's the question we wanted to answer. So remember that our hope was that, you know, starting from a static solution with conical singularities, you perturb the brain stress energy. And rather than getting a runaway solution, you'd evolve to another static solution to non-conical singularities. Now we've seen that the non-conical singularities depend on these p6 terms, on this extra dimensional part of this brain stress energy even there. So now the question becomes, can these p6 terms evolve so as to keep the solution static when you change the brain stress energy? And the answer is that nothing in the equations of motion tells you that they have. Furthermore, if you look at the Friedman equation for the Hubble rate, then the p6 terms don't even appear. So what happens is that in order to get a static solution, regardless of whether or not you have non-conical singularities, you're going to have to do some tuning between the brake tensions and the gauge flux. Okay, so you cannot use the non-conical singularities to set the Hubble rate to zero through a phase transition.
Now just let me remind you, so that the whole analysis for the sums of the zeroth order tensions are zero, right?
Right.
So does that mean that these rows, so the thing that really wasn't bad would be if these energy densities were of the order of the, you know, the least scale to the fourth power, and that would mean that the zeroth order tensions are zero. So how big can they be within the domain of your...
But it's not a question of the size. I mean, what we're looking for is self-tuning behavior. So what we hope for is that you start with a brainless static background, and then you perturb the brain, right? Okay. You hope to get a static solution with tensions on the brain, regardless of whether or not they're small, right? Because we're doing things perturbatively, but hopefully you could say, well, if we make these things big, we'll get a static solution anyway. What you would want to happen would be to have something like this. If you have a rho plus p term here instead of rho, then you could say this is a solution because, you know, true attention is not going to add anything to the Hubble rate. So the fact that this is small, I mean, we're doing a perturbative calculation, but if there was self-tuning going on here, we would see a perturbative. A small perturbation would lead to another static solution. Here it doesn't. I don't see how you could get self-tuning by putting larger tensions on the brain, right, if you don't get it frequently.
This would be just kind of the target. I think I accept your argument that you're showing in essence here that something like lambda 3 is a constant, or it's something which is much like given the profile of the integral equation most you're finding, it's also an integral here, so you can't generate it beyond zero, it didn't start off.
Right.
I think I buy that, but if, as far as whether or not that kills the proposal of the constant, it doesn't necessarily, because you've got a flat direction, and the issue is how fast is that flat, are you going? At the end of the day, the flat directions are going to make you roll in that flat direction anyway, but at a rate which could be consistent with quintessence. So the question is this bigger than that?
Sure, but the thing is, I mean, you can imagine, okay, this is a perturbative calculation, so these rolls can't be too large. Right. That's a given. But the behavior you see here, though, is that imagine that you did have, these were pure tension, okay, and they were canceled by q1. Okay, so you start out with perturbatively small terms, a static solution. Now, if you have a phase transition where rho changes, then this change in the tension is going to contribute directly to expansion. So when the tension goes to a phase transition, you don't just get another static solution. You get the contribution to the Hubble rate.
You're asking a question. Let me re-ask the question to focus it more. Is that don't just take everything as big as can be. The worst case scenario, what you really have to do is pick all those things as big as the least scale of the fourth power, but you can in the domain of your approximation, but you can still make it as big as you can within the domain of your approximation. And what I want to know is, can I test the steepness of the potential within that domain? So what's the biggest I can make these rows?
Okay, that's something we haven't even talked to, really. The size of these things to me, I don't know. Yeah. It would be...
Can I know, because I have to deal with that. If you can establish that, there are some things that you can get a source term which is bigger than it would have to be to... The thing that would be dangerous to you, if this thing is bigger than the quantum corrections, which are very small, which is a surprise. So if these things were big and but still small enough that you could, if they're small compared to the weak scale, so that you could do your preferred analysis, then you'd be in business, where you can say that it's small but still big enough to kill them.
We weren't thinking of the size of these things. We were really looking just for a self-limiting behavior. So we wanted to see if automatically you'd always get a zero contribution to the Hubble rate from the pure attention. That's what we were looking for. So we wanted to think about this. And so I'd like to maybe on a more hopeful note. These P6 terms, I mean, if you had if you could construct a concrete model for a big brain where these terms actually cancel the right hand side of this, you could use these terms to make the right hand side as small as you need to make the dynamics of the extra dimension fit with experimental data. That's something you can imagine doing. So these extra dimensional components of the brain stress energy tensor could be used to stabilize this right away direction. And one thing you have to, I think an important point from our results is that the actual structure of the brain is very important to the behavior that you're going to get out of these models, right? Which is something that hadn't been appreciated as much before the certain code mentioned two brains. So whether or not you have these six terms is going to change greatly the outcome. So the internal structure is important. And if these terms are there, then I don't see how you can have an effective four-dimensional description of these things because of a violation of cross-dimensional dimension.
Well, you can also have effective four-dimensional scales. If you separate scales, you're not an effective theory. The question is, you have more effective operators than just attention. And so I think that's a really important problem, is to identify the matching. How do you match those things onto the effective four-dimensional action, whatever it is?
Right.
No doubt.
That's a problem here. Okay, so the conclusion is four-dimensional two grades are interesting because you get an unconventional relation. At first, you think you get no relation between the Hubble rate and vacuum energy, and when you dig deeper, you get an unconventional relation. It makes you think that you might be able to attack a couple of problems. But there's always an implicit relation between the expansion rate and the vacuum energy, so that, in fact, there is no self-and the effective description apparently is strongly dependent on the details of brain structure, and that's a problem with this thing that we at least detect. And, well, there's, as I said, there's a possibility of stabilizing the using these extra-dimensional terms in the stress energy tensor on the brain. But, I mean, if you don't have a concrete model for the brain, that's not very important. So fine-tuning is still needed to make cosmological constants small, but as Cliff was saying, I mean, supersymmetric large extra dimensions do explain the smallest of constant corrections, which is in itself the large
problem. Well, they may,
depending
on the check of operators are. That's why.
And I haven't mentioned this here, but there was a paper recently where someone in Caleb Ridden studied solutions where he did not extremize those symmetry between each extra dimension. That might be something that's worth looking at. Though I don't think it would lead to subtuning, but it certainly just to see what it meant.
So do we have some more questions for our speaker? I think
I'm troubled by this self-tuning sort of concept in general. From the 4D point of view,
sure.
What is it? I mean, is it like saying that okay, I have some sort of quintessence-like solution, right? If I, for example, I have scalar field with exponential potential, right? And then I can make a Planck to the fourth, right? And then if I'm allowed to add terms there, right, then it will always relax to some sort of because of the rolling, right?
Right.
The rolling point. Is that what the final sort of goal of this thing is? To get some sort of quintessence-like scenario?
I don't know. Probably from a 40 point of view, it would look like that. But
yeah. Isn't it the first question to answer and then go to all this extremely intricate construction?
Well, the thing is, as you've seen, is you do have effects coming from the extra dimensions that are not easy to describe at the 40.2.
I certainly agree with that. It's got to be a new degrees of freedom or something like that.
Sure, but they're going to come in and
it's easily identifiable that to the P, but it has to be done in the new field. If you put something in then the right-hand side of the Einstein equations, and coming from internal structure or whatever, that means that you have new degrees of freedom.
Sure, but the way they're going to end is the 40 attributes is going to be highly non-free.
Well, but the question is, what is the self-tuning from the 40 point of view? Is it really has to be a quintessence or not? Right? If there are no light degrees of freedom additional, right? There is no self-tuning period, right? Is that correct statement?
I guess so. You need to have new degrees of freedom.
And then yeah, they have to be so really, really locked, right? I mean, in some sense, so sort of listening to all. Otherwise, I can integrate them out, and I don't have anything.
Right? It's all right.
It would be very helpful for the community if someone really spells it out, right? Because I have some that
giving me. No, I think you're right. If anything that algorithm has to, if it's going to work, has to have a lifetime agreement, it's going to be, I guess, it's not, because otherwise it wouldn't be able to adjust
Then the next question is that this quintessence has to couple to standard model as well, right? Because otherwise you get the regular corrections from the standard model that are not dressed by quintessence.
Right, so that's the whole natural situation. So that point that the whole, so I don't know at some point you're going to release the term, but the statement would be that if you don't do anything, then cutoffs as big as 10 minus 3 electron volts is as big as you can live in 4 dimensions. And the whole point of this whole picture is that so at that point, you leave 4 dimensions and you have to do everything at scale higher than that in higher dimensions. And that's why you have to ask these questions. Because what's happening in higher dimensions is that we made it so that none of us, the structural physics, none of the things, the only thing changed is gravity, essentially, at that scale. Because all of particles.
Well, you also have lots of new matter coming at.
Okay. Exactly. So that's why you have to answer the question in higher dimensions, because the interesting part of it is happening in scales which are higher dimensional. Once you make that work, it's always going to be true that the law behind it is going to be determined in terms of 4 dimensions. You can't scale lower than 10 last year. The question is what those, know all those pieces of figure are, you have to ask where they come from, and that's, you learn where they come from, what the properties are by addressing the naturalness to the next scale. That's how.
Any further questions?
I think it's a good one.
I get the same results that all the constants would be dependent on. The background tension.
I think that if you were to do one referring that paper.